Welcome to Investor Resources with your hosts, Don Creech and Perry Sykes, who both realize that the market doesn't know what keeps you up at night. It doesn't know when you want to retire, and it doesn't know how old you are. The simple truth is, the market doesn't care. But if you care, then you've tuned in at the perfect time. You're listening to Investor Resources, bringing clarity to the confusing world of finance. Here are your hosts of Investor Resources, Don Creech and Perry Sykes.
Well, good afternoon. This is Don Creech.
And this is Perry Sykes. Welcome to the show, everyone.
So it's been a few years since you've heard our voices. Some of you may never have, but we have been on here before, and we are back. Well, as far as the market doesn't care, that's really true. If the market, if Mr. Market cared about you individually, it would never go down, right?
I don't think it cares.
Yeah, it doesn't care. Anyway, this is a live call-in show, and we talk about stock market and things that we believe are going to have an impact on it, may have an impact on you. You have questions about something in your portfolio or something that your neighborhood financial advisor has suggested you really need to have in your portfolio and you want a second opinion, here's an opportunity to get one. 800, all you have to do is pick up the phone and call 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. You call in and you'll get, end up, as long as you're on topic here, stock market and economy, you'll end up on the board, and we will be glad to talk with you. This last week, Mr. Market was somewhat schizophrenic. Normally on Wednesday when the Fed releases when Jay Powell gets up and talks about their meeting and then they release the minutes and people get a chance to take a look at that, there's some jittery reactions. But Wednesday it was like, yeah, nothing new here.
We're okay. It's going to be fine.
Until in the evening when Mr. Market had time to read through the details and think about it, he came in on Thursday and said, Chicken Little story, the sky is falling, let's get out of here.
And everybody did. Everybody headed for the exits.
Yeah, we did. It just ran away until Friday. And they said, you know, maybe we read too fast. The Powell is not going to raise interest rates. That's what he told us. Anytime soon. They're just thinking that maybe they're going to have to raise interest rates, and so they're going to start talking about it. But they've been talking about it since 2009 because they want to raise inflation. They don't want to raise interest rates. That would be a recession. They want to raise inflation. And so far, they haven't figured out how to do that, but it is happening not because of Fed action. The Fed doesn't control inflation.
They wish they did, and they'll tell you they can, but nothing they've done has really brought any inflation about, and it's mostly supply chain issues and money supply that have done it, and they couldn't get that done.
So basically, what's driving the stock market? Why did it recover so rapidly from such a disastrous day on Thursday? The basic answer is, the thing that affects the stock market is most everything right now.
It's true. There are so many variables. There are so many inputs that that move the market around. To put your finger on one thing and say that's the only thing, it's a tough thing right now. But some things are bigger than others.
You know, it's been so long since we've been here on KTTH. We should probably introduce our firm. Say, why are we here? Well, we've actually been on the radio on various stations for, I think we're going on 13 years now.
13 years. All right. Yeah.
Investor Resources is a registered investment advisor, which means we are a fiduciary in all of our client engagements. We have no broker dealer affiliation to sell anything. We do not get commissions from anything. We don't sell real estate. We don't sell annuities. We don't sell DSTs. We don't sell anything. We manage portfolios. And our objective is to follow Warren Buffett's rule number one. Don't lose money. And of course, if there's one rule, there's got to be more, right? So rule number two is don't forget rule number one. So we approach markets with a concern over drawdown risk. You don't like it. We don't like it. It's bad for business. It's bad for retirement. It's bad for legacy. losing money is just not what you're supposed to do or what you think is going to happen when the market, when you invest in the market. But in reality, bear markets occur. Now, most of the people who we talk to who are not clients have a portfolio that's built around modern portfolio theory, which sounds so good.
It's a great story. It's a great story. And the math actually works. It's just you have to have an unlimited amount of time for it to work for your portfolio. And I don't know anyone like that. We've never come across anyone that says, I don't know when my portfolio needs to be great, but it's okay. Whenever is okay. It's never okay, especially if you're in retirement. You need to be taken care of right now.
Well, modern portfolio theory is the same amount of modern as maybe your grandpa's Studebaker.
That's it.
Because it was developed in 1952. And the other problem with it actually is that Dr. Markowitz, who developed the thesis, it's actually a dissertation, that he eventually, in 1990, got a Nobel Prize for, which is why everybody loves to say, this can't be wrong, because look, he got a Nobel Prize for this work. Well, yes, he did. But he's also said, the financial services industry misapplies my work. It was never intended to be used for asset allocation. It was a declaration of volatility. And that volatility is a key concern in your portfolio, but it is not how you diversify your portfolio. It doesn't matter. The financial services industry, and we have been in it long enough to be fully indoctrinated in how to sell modern portfolio theory.
And that's the key. You just said it, Don. That's the key. To sell. Modern portfolio theory and that pie chart have become a massive marketing theme, and it's important to remember that that's what it is. It's a marketing theme, and it's not really a great way to run your portfolio.
Certainly not. No, so anyway, let's back. That's what we do anyway. And we have a website, iriradio.com. And speaking of the website, we don't have it up yet, but we did one of our monthly stock market update webinars this morning at 9:15. And it ran about an hour and 10 minutes, I think, with the Q&A. And we will have that posted probably tomorrow. It needs a little bit of editing on the front end, because we run a pre-webinar program to entertain people who log on early, and we don't need to post that. It's a bunch of pretty pictures and funny cartoons and stuff. So I have to edit that stuff out. We'll get it up. But if you go to the website now, iriradio.com, that's iriradio.com, under the video tab, you will find our previous webinars. And what would, for those of you who aren't unfamiliar with us, which is probably most of you in this audience today, if you go back to January, you go to video tab, scroll down to the January one. That's the one where I suggest you watch, because we walk through one of our key models and how we made decisions last year and missed the damage of the pandemic, which gave us a ton of money to invest at much cheaper prices when the market started to turn up. And it was a huge benefit across the board with all of our models.
And that's one of those benefits you don't get if you're in a pie chart advisor, with working with a pie chart advisor. They don't try to get out of the way. In fact, they'll tell you that's very dangerous. You shouldn't be moving your money around. You need to leave it alone. And that's how you can tell you're getting a sales pitch. Their main concern is to make sure your money stays with them through thick and thin, and they'll say anything they need to say to do that. We would rather do something to protect our clients' capital than tell them a story about how in 25 years everything's going to be fine. You'll forget that this ever happened, and they're a much better way to do that.
Well, here you go back. Let's go back to Harry Markowitz, who developed the modern portfolio theory as it is misapplied by the industry today, and take a look at just the probability of a bear market. The math says bear markets only occur once every 500 years. And I can guarantee everybody in this audience has seen more than one bear market, unless you're very young.
Correct. And by the way, we've heard that come out of Janet Yellen's mouth. She's said that herself. So she's, you know, that's the standardized methodology right now. And she believes that too. And it's very, very dangerous because, as you just said, Don, they seem to happen a lot more than every 500 years. I don't know.
So I think we've had 18 since 1929. But you're right. I'd forgotten about Janet Yellen when she was chair of the Fed.
Yep.
In testifying in front of Congress. And this was in the aftermath of the Brexit issue. And we had some other issues. And the market was down in... So that was 16. Yeah, that's when we had Brexit. Anyway, after that, I mean, she's in Congress and she's talking about financial stability and that we're not going to have another bear market for 500 years because that's statistically the probability of a bear market because when they fall, they are often so severe, they're just never supposed to happen. And the theory of being broadly diversified and just buy and hold is not going to happen in your lifetime because the math says so. Except Mr. Market doesn't always pay attention to the math.
To academia. It's a beautiful piece of math, and the math works as long as you have, like I said, unlimited time. But that doesn't necessarily mean it works out in real life. And that's where, you know, our clients live. We can't invest over the past 100 years. We have to invest right now. And so looking at what has happened over long time periods really doesn't do you any good. You need to know what's going on in the markets currently and adapt your portfolio for what's going on there. And I think we're right up on our first break here, Don. We should go ahead and we got to get our first break right. We got to go ahead and get out of here. We're going to work on it. We're going to like to remind everybody that we do have our next market update. We have them every month. That's scheduled for August 7th at 9:15 a.m. And you can register for that by going to irradio.com. That is irradio.com. Just go to the webinar page. Click the registration link and you'll get an email back. There's a link in there. And on August 7th, you just click that link and you will be live online with us. You'll be able to see our screens, see the charts we're talking about, and go a long way to helping you get a little clarity in your investing life. You are listening to Investor Resources. Excuse me. You are listening to Investor Resources here on AM 770 KTTH. Stay with us. We will be right back.
You got to know when to hold up.
Well, anybody who's ever played poker or any other card game knows that that's the case. But what most financial advisors in dealing with clients talk about it, you're never supposed to walk away from the market. It doesn't matter how bad your hand is. You're supposed to hang on to it through thick and thin. And assuming that someday all the chips will come back to you. And we just simply do not subscribe to that theory anymore. That was a result of the last bear market in 08-09, when after religiously applying MPT across our portfolios and hiring institutional money managers where all the smart money is, all the smart guys, the MBAs, the CFAs, the PhDs, I mean, if you talk to any financial advisor, they say, the guys on Wall Street, they're on the inside and we're going to have them manage your account.
And we had those guys. Yeah, we had all those guys and that universally, they told us the same thing. Don't worry. We've seen this before. We know what to do. We'll take care of this. Don't worry. And then in 2008 and 2009, they did virtually nothing. I mean, nothing. And that's when it dawned on us, you know what? That's their job. Their job is to do nothing. That's the way that process works.
Well, that's what the theory says. You basically, you get in that situation because you answer a risk questionnaire. How old are you? When are you going to retire? When are you going to need the money? How much income do you have? How much debt do you have? You got to put the kids through college. You're going to do drawdown. What are you going to do with the money? And then the really important one, how much are you willing to lose before you bail on this plan?
That question's always there. It's almost like we want to know what your pain threshold is, and then we're going to deliver it. And so get ready. This is going to hurt just as bad as you choose.
And every one of your answers has a number assigned to it. They add all the numbers up and they take a look at their algorithm and say, well, it looks to me like you should be in a balanced portfolio. 60-40 stocks, bonds, maybe 55-45. I mean, it's somewhere in that range. Almost everyone who comes to see us is in a balanced portfolio and saying, you know, we're not making any money here. I mean, the market's going up and we're just kind of treading water. Well, yeah, because if this was a boat, you have two anchors hanging out over the side while you're revving your motor up. It doesn't work that way. When you hold on to money losing assets, trying to make money, and two come to mind. Because we were on the air on another station back in 2011, summer of 2011, and we said, you should no longer hang on to either gold or emerging markets. It's not that we knew anything about the future, because we did not and still do not know anything about the future, but we were looking at market-generated data, just the stuff that goes on continually changing in the market. And market-generated data said, these things have topped out. They are going south. And guess what? They are still south of June 2011. Now, they've had some rallies. They've been brief. So when is the rally that's going to recover and last until you get back to even with 2011? I mean, the money that's in your portfolio, because you are diversified, you know, not all your eggs in one basket, but it's still a basket that has a leak in it, which means that you are offsetting anything else you have that actually is doing well.
Plus, it's important to remember that pie chart, all that stuff in your basket. They always say don't put everything in one basket. That whole concept is built around the belief that there should always be something in your portfolio losing money. If something's going up, something else is going to go down. That's how it's supposed to work. So when things in your portfolio are heading south, as far as they're concerned, that's not a problem. That's not a bug. It's a feature. You know, that's how it's supposed to work. And we simply just don't understand that. Everyone is doing this for the same reason. We're all here to make money. We're all here to make money on the money we're going to invest. And to sit around and watch a piece of it consistently lose money, sometimes for years, and the reaction to that is, well, let's buy more. It keeps going down. Let's keep buying more. It's just something that we have come to believe is a huge mistake.
Well, and in order to buy more, how do we get the money?
Here we go.
But I'm losing money, and you want me to give you more? And you say, no, you don't have to do that. What we're going to do is sell your winners to generate the cash to buy your losers. That has a marketing term to it. It's called, we'll rebalance your portfolio on a quarterly basis.
And it's built in. We're going to automatically sell high and buy low. It sounds so good, but when you look at it as, well, I've got stuff that's making a ton of money, I'm going to have less. And I've got stuff that's losing a ton of money, and I'm going to have more. On the premise that at some point, they're going to reverse. And then one will still be making money and one will still be losing money, but it'll be the opposite direction. And somehow that's supposed to make you feel better. And we've seen it in operation. We know that in times of market volatility and in large drawdowns, everything goes down together. So there just is no safety built in there, but that's what they want you to believe.
Well, everybody knows that you're supposed to buy low and sell high. What the financial advisor system does not train any advisor to do is to sell high so that you'll have cash to buy low. So I mentioned in the last segment, you should go log on. You're unfamiliar with this. Log on to our website, iriradio.com. Go to the video tab and scroll down to the January stock market update webinar and watch it. You will learn something that your financial advisor has told you is impossible to do. Market-generated data forced every one of our portfolios to go to cash. So you want to buy low, sell high. You must first be willing to sell high so you have the cash when prices collapse to actually re-enter it and grow that portfolio without the loss in the middle. It makes a huge difference in total returns.
It does. It makes a huge difference. And we never sell stuff based on, well, it's been going up a long time, let's just sell a bunch, or at random rebalancing points. You know, every quarter we're just going to sell whatever's doing well and buy whatever's doing poorly. We listen to the market. We watch where the cash is flowing. If cash is still coming into an asset, we'll keep it. If it goes up for 5 years in a row, we want to own that. We're not going to sell that. We may add to it, but we're not going to get rid of it. And by listening to what's going on in the market instead of an arbitrary rebalancing formula, you can hang on to the winners and let them run and cut the losers short. That's the concept we work by.
So there are a lot of things that suggest that the market's overpriced, one of which would be what's called the Shiller PE ratio or the CAPE ratio, cyclically adjusted price earnings. It's almost as high as at the top of the tech bubble in 2000. Yeah. There aren't many other places where it's been this extended. By definition, that means it's a high-risk market, and certainly has some signs of uncertainty, one of which is that the ISM report on manufacturing is highly correlated to stock market performance, and it has already peaked out and is dropping. But we don't expect stock prices to drop right away, partly because next week, actually this week is coming up, earnings season starts in earnest, and there are going to be some phenomenal earning numbers. Because year over year, you're looking at my base comparison point is the depths of the pandemic sell-off last year. So if your earnings, corporate earnings, didn't go up this last year, man, you need new management.
Right. They're going to be stepping over a very low bar here, and they should look fabulous. But having a beat in earnings right now is not going to be that big a deal. You need to look a little further back and compare it to 2 years ago and see how are we doing now. You know, where are we from pre-pandemic numbers? And those are the kinds of trend watching that we do to see if things are trending up or if we're getting a short-term bounce. But it's all coming from data that the market is generating. It's never, you know, you were talking about manufacturing, Don. We will never see a manufacturing index number and then start making trades based on the manufacturing index. It's got to get into the prices. Prices tell you the truth about where things are. And like you said, Don, if stocks continue to go up, we want to continue to own them. We're not going to sell them because there was bad news somewhere in the economy. It's got to get into stock prices first before it matters.
So you mentioned prices, and this is something that we've covered on a number of our webinars, and that is we can argue whether an individual security price is too high or too low. If you're a value buyer, most of the time you think the price is too high. If you're a growth buyer, you think, well, it's an opportunity. It's bound to go even higher. But one thing we cannot argue about is what's the price. I mean, we know what the price is every minute the market's open. At the end of the day, we know what the price was when the market closed. It is what it is. That is not debatable. And when you take today's price and yesterday's price and the prices that go back over the last several months and you draw a line through there, you end up with a trend. It's not rocket science. And the trend is your friend, as the adage goes in the market. You want to stay with the trend. And when the trend falls apart, there's no reason to stay with it. When your sail breaks, falls into the water, and becomes a sea anchor, you need another solution. And that's usually a systematic, reasoned process to rotate into new leadership. Because the market rotates based on where the economy is growing. Not all sectors, not all stocks do well all the time, except that the standard portfolio says that doesn't matter. We're just going to own a whole bunch of stuff, and we know some of it will work out.
Throw it at the wall and see what sticks. We think that's a little too general, though. There's too many losers in that format, so we do not like to do it. Let's get out of here, Don. We got to have a break here at the bottom of the bottom of the hour. If you don't receive our week in review, we have a weekly email newsletter, give you a little heads up about what's gone on the previous week, let you know what's important to think about and things that you can largely ignore. If you'd like to start getting that, it's a freebie. Just send us an email to help@iriradio.com. That is help@iriradio.com. Just put week in review in the subject line, and we need your first and last name, and that's it. We will get you in the system, and you will begin receiving that this Monday. You are listening to Investor Resources here on AM 770 KTTH. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
So I'm telling you right now, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive.
Well, that's true in most anything. That's true in sports, certainly, and that's true in the stock market. Only the strong survive. Which is interesting because the S&P 500 is an actively managed index which consistently adds new companies after they have had a phenomenally long upward trek in pricing. And then they don't get rid of them until they are on the verge of bankruptcy.
You want to talk about behind the curve. Going in and out of the S&P 500 is a slow process.
In fact, I don't have the article in front of me, but there was an article that came across my computer here this week that the addition of Tesla to the S&P 500 actually has cost people, investors, something like $49 billion.
Ouch, yeah.
Because of the addition of Tesla to the S&P 500. But be that as it may, it's still at new highs, and the market seems to be driving upward. And the real question is, how high is high enough? And nobody actually knows the answer. We do know that we're not quite as high as the ratio would indicate from the tech bubble in 2000, but we are high enough historically that it should have some concern. So people are still buying the market. And where's all that money coming from? That's pretty simple. People are just buying stocks. Part of that is there's a large number of people who put money into the stock market through their 401k every other week, twice a month, whatever their pay system is, without regard to prices.
They're buying, and they're buying typically all the time.
Yeah, they're typically in one of those modern 1952 portfolio structures. You got a 529 plan, Roth IRA, IRA, SEP IRA. That money just continues to flow in on a regular basis. We have low interest rates, which makes it difficult to go to the bank and get anything attractive. In fact, interest rates, the 10-year Treasury bond this week came really close to 1.25%.
It did.
For a 10-year commitment.
and even at those rates, unless you don't need the money, bankers don't really want to look at you right now. It can be tough to get a loan these days.
Pension plans, they have obligations to meet. In fact, pension plans have been big buyers of bonds when the longer dated bonds were closer to 2%. So 2% for 20 years or 30, okay. Mm. But pension plans, they know they're going to be spending money for retirees for the next 75 to 100 years. They are truly long-term investors, but that's probably longer than your time horizon. But interest rates are as low as they are, and most pension plans are underfunded. We can start with a government plan, but that's not a problem. That just tax you and me. If you're a state employee, you are actually in one of the very few states that has a sound pension plan.
Washington's been doing a very good job. Yes, indeed.
It's well funded.
Yep.
But any other place around the country, they need more money. And the way they get it is to raise taxes, or they have to put some money in the stock market and get a better return. We have tens of thousands of baby boomers who are retiring on a regular basis every day, and they've got tons of money. And the standard process is, well, you're older. You can't afford to have all that money in the stock market. So we're going to go buy bonds because bonds are safer.
But they are. Yeah, they just keep pumping the money in. And, you know, it doesn't matter how often we point out that rates are unbelievably low right now. And do you believe that those rates are going to stay low forever? Or do you think those, you know, the interest rates are going to start trending up? And when they do, your bonds lose value. Bonds are a risky proposition right now, especially if it becomes the majority part of your portfolio.
Which it will if you are getting older, and most of us are, because the alternative doesn't look too good.
No, I'm forgetting older,
You go into your financial advisor, or you get on your website, and you update your risk questionnaire, and it is, your age. Well, you're older than the last time we reviewed this. You should have more bonds. And the reason for that recommendation is that over the last 35 years or so, interest rates have declined more than 90%. And depending upon the index, interest rates on bonds have averaged somewhere between 5.5% and 7% over the last 3.5 decades. That's the assumption that you're going to get built into your model, your model portfolio, and why they say you should own more bonds. But you're making the assumption that over the next 30 years, interest rates will fall another 90% from current levels. Mm. And upon closer examination, we've never had anybody say, yeah, that's what I believe is going to happen.
That
they
can't
say, you've got to be kidding me.
That can't be very likely. And that's what is necessary to repeat the bond bull market over the past 35 years. And yet, that's what gets baked into your portfolio, the assumption that that is going to occur again. And mathematically, it can't happen. It can't happen. So you're setting yourself up to miss your goals because you're going to end up owning so much of the percentage of your assets in bonds as you age and get into retirement. And they are not going to return the same as they did the last 35 years. They can't.
And that's statistically unlikely.
Correct.
So who's buying all these bonds? Well, some people are, we mentioned it's the pension plans, they are. Some people following their financial advisor's advice are dumping more money into bonds. But one of the big buyers, particularly of treasuries, are foreign investors because they have negative interest rates.
We're low, but we're not negative, so they're coming here still.
And so it's a better buy than anything else. They keep any other bonds in their country, so they keep buying our bonds, which keeps our interest rates lower than they probably otherwise would be. And millennials are the largest generation in the United States, and much of this demographic now is in their mid-30s, early to mid-30s. And this is a time historically when people settle down. They get married, they have kids, and pretty soon they want their own backyard for the safety of their children to play in, and they start buying houses. Well, buying houses is really a fundamental key to keeping a strong economy. It is a core of our economic growth.
And people are buying houses right now like crazy. The difficult thing is finding a house that's for sale. And then if you do, finding a house for sale that you can afford is even tougher. But the market is just hot as a firecracker coast to coast. Houses are just flying off the market.
Well, unless you're in an inner city. And there has been a big exodus into cheaper areas. Also, they come frequently with better security in the communities.
And people are buying houses, sure, to get out of the downtown condo. If you've been living downtown with two kids, it's going to be nice to have a backyard to go turn them loose in. And that's happening as fast as people can get it done. Therefore, people keep buying houses.
Well, and low interest rates are keeping mortgage rates down, and that helps support that. The offset of that is house prices are really high, and if you don't have good credit and you don't have a down payment, that's a problem.
You got trouble, yep.
You might have equity in your own home, and you say, well, I can sell it. Well, yes, but if you sell it and you don't have another one to move into, and you probably don't want to live on a tent in the street or the local park. That's not so safe. But that is that construction issue is keeping people employed in the construction trades. But that has some problems. One is labor, trying to find people who will actually go to work and do the building. And lumber has been a real problem because it has been so expensive, though, as I covered in today's webinar, that the price of lumber over the last several months has dropped 50%. But that's not enough to make builders think, well, I can go build a whole subdivision. No, because other prices like copper and aluminum, these other metals that are necessary, steel, that are used in home construction, they haven't come down with lumber.
And a lot of those builders did that. They did that in 2008, and they got left holding the bag. And there were so many new neighborhoods and subdivisions that didn't get finished. And those same builders are out there now today saying, well, I managed to survive. I'm not going to go do that again right away. So it's going to take a while for this to get back into balance. It will, but it's not going to happen quickly.
And that's a really good point. I mean, that's hindsight bias. That's what it's called. And justifiably so. If you barely survived the last downturn because prices were astronomically high at the time, and you're saying, I don't know about this one. I don't know that I want to risk my entire financial career 10 years
again.
Down the road.
Yeah.
Again. So we're going to take a very cautious outlook on this. And it's probably going to work its way out over the next 4, 5, 6 years. It will stabilize. Prices will probably come down in the lumber area. Many mills, sawmills, processors were really struggling themselves to stay in business.
You bet.
And there's been a lot of consolidation, and consolidation means there's less competition in the production side. And that means prices may not come down as much, and we're going to get used to higher prices, which the Fed doesn't want. I mean, if lumber stays where it is and starts to rise again, house prices are going to keep going up, and we have continuous long-term demand from the millennial generation. And some of the older homes, they get demolished. I mean, not everybody wants an old house that doesn't have Wi-Fi built in and
have that
Ring
smart house
on the doorbell.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So there's an inventory issue here that has to be addressed. And all of these, we're talking about housing. We're not in the real estate business, but housing is important for the economy to grow, which is important for the stock market to grow. So we see there's this underlying support and pressure, but at very extended prices. So what is the plan that when this starts to fall apart, not if, when this all starts to fall apart and take a big breather, which in the stock market is called the bear market, how do you protect your capital? Bonds don't protect your capital. Gold doesn't protect your capital. The standard industry mantra is you sit still and take it. You hang on because it will come back. And yes, it will. After the tech bubble, it only took 13 years to get even with tech stocks. After the great financial crisis, it only took 7 and a fraction years to get even and get back up to the 07 high. So, you know, you maintain a long-term view of maybe a couple of decades. I say a couple of decades because if it was the 60s and the 70s and you were a buy and hold investor, you went through 20 years to break even on a buy and hold basis with the S&P 500.
And don't forget to keep your broker happy during those periods. They would really appreciate it if you didn't spend any of your money. We're going to need all that to stay in there. So it really puts a freeze on everything. It stops your ability to meet your goals, and it can really suck the wind out of retirement, which is why we think protecting capital is at the top of the list. That's the most important thing. Don't take the big hit, and you're going to have some money to reinvest when things turn around. We are up against our final break of the afternoon here. I'd like to remind you that on Saturday, August 7th, we're having our next market update at 9:15 in the morning. You can register for that by going to IRIRadio.com. That is IRIRadio.com. Just go to the webinar page, give the registration link a click, and you're going to get an email back with a link in it. And on August 7th, you click that link, you'll be live online with us. We'll go through what's going on in the market, what's going on in the economy, and we always have plenty of time to answer your questions about investing. Or if you have questions about specific securities, it's a great time to get a second opinion. Just let us know what the ticker is, and we'll cover that with you. Again, register for that by going to IRIRadio.com. You are listening to Investor Resources. We're on AM 770 KTTH. Stay with us. We will be right back.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like?
Well, I normally use that when we have been talking about the administration spending plans, though those spending
the big
plans,
government spending, yes.
Yeah, those spending plans aren't doing very well. They aren't going very far. There's a lot of division. But I actually put it in here today because the big spender today that the government is counting on and has been for more than a year now is you, the U.S. consumer. You are to be the big spenders that will drive us into a much larger and stronger economy. That was the reason for the payroll support and the next payroll support and the unemployment compensation boost and all the other money that's been given to households was not because they thought they were necessarily in dire straits, though some certainly were, but it was, here's money, go spend it. But don't go to the store. Well, maybe the grocery store, the pharmacy, we'll leave those open. You're going to have gasoline. But don't go to the store, the shop. But spend the money. That was the confusing message. And so people went online, and they spent a lot of it, and they did, and that helped the online retail establishment companies. But what didn't happen that shocked government is they didn't spend all the money.
There was a lot of people out there. Yep, a lot of people out there decided, you know what? Things are very uncertain right here. We're going to save some of this. We're going to put some of this in the bank. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to pay down my credit card, too. So instead of burning through that, they actually paid down their credit card. So people are in much better shape, many people, post-pandemic than they were before because of all that stimulus money. And because they used it very wisely, which was not what the government wanted, but it was the right thing to do for your personal economy.
Well, and it improved their credit scores.
Great deal.
So for those who want to go out and buy a new home or maybe their first home, they're in better shape than they were a year and a half ago.
Indeed.
So
indeed.
That's good. And low interest rates on mortgages. I mean, we're looking at historically low rates. Man, they were a little lower last year, but they're not high. That's certainly true. And so right now, we are in a position where the consumer is on good fiscal footing to actually be an economic stimulus for the economy. However, there's always a however, right?
Always, yeah.
So the San Francisco Fed thought this is interesting, and they hired a group of academics to do a research project. What happens to economies after pandemics? Now, there aren't a lot to study. There's two major ones, massive ones globally. And the first one that comes to mind, the Spanish flu. But be that as it may, they did this research project for the San Francisco Fed, and the Fed released a report last week. And what they saw, I think, scared them. Because the result of going through a global pandemic, the likes of which we'd never done before, because never before has the world shut down business and said, don't go out of your house.
Just flat turned it off. Yeah, it hasn't happened before.
So what the academics said was most likely is we are going to see a pandemic response economically that is similar to the depression mentality post-30s. People who went through the 30s didn't trust banks, didn't trust the government, didn't trust business, and they were afraid that they were going to lose their job again, and so they saved. They were great savers.
All of everything.
That's right. I don't know if you ever knew people who saved balls of strings and balls of rubber bands because you didn't know if you were ever going to get them again.
I don't think anybody can save newspaper anymore because I'm not sure many people get a newspaper anymore.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah. In fact, I get one, and I'm about ready to not renew it.
There you go. There you go.
But in any event, this is a terrible shock to the system if people decide that they're going to be more fiscally responsible and carry less debt. Debt is the engine of our economy. It's called the fractional banking system. It's not government. It's not the Fed printing money. It doesn't really print. But it's not the Fed creating money out of thin air, which it does do, giving it to the big banks. And the banks are then supposed to lend it. You're supposed to borrow it. And it's the borrowing process that causes inflation. It's expanding that monetary availability, money availability, and buying more things in the system.
That's money in the economy. Yeah, that's not money in banks. That's money in the economy. And that causes inflation. Inflation is, you know, too many dollars chasing too few goods and services. And that's where those dollars come from.
And now if the reaction is, yeah, I don't think I'm going to borrow the money for that. I'm going to wait until I can afford it. Maybe I don't need it. That does not expand the economy. That's a problem for the Fed. Well, the Fed has two problems. We have some inflationary issues that they say are transitory, and our opinion is not so much.
Best case is no one knows if it's transitory or not.
And transitory, they don't define it. Does transitory mean 6 months or 6 years or longer? Because all inflation is transitory. It never lasts forever, but the period of time involved can be quite long. So you look at employers today who can't find people to come to work in their establishment. They are offering bonuses to hire on and a higher wage. And people go in and they get started and stuff. And then they say, I don't like these circumstances. And I can get a better job down the street where he just raised his wage level. And so they quit. And now we've got another place of employment that needs another worker. And there is not a bank full of laborers, employee potentials that they can hire. This is unusual circumstance. For every job opening in the country today, there is one unemployed person. Guess who gets to set the rules? The employee.
Like you said, Don, that is not normal coming out of a recession, but this is not a normal shutdown. This is very abnormal, and now the recovery is just as abnormal. It's not behaving in the same patterns that we've seen before, and it's kind of throwing everybody off, and no one's quite sure how to deal with it. And all you can really do is wait for it to unwind. See where the strengths are, watch for the weaknesses, and if you're an employee right now, you're in the catbird seat. There are plenty of jobs out there, plenty of employees, like you said, Don, willing to pay you a bonus just to show up. And so right now, it's the employees have all the leverage right now.
So how transitory are wage hikes?
That's a good one. Yep. Yep.
The Fed thinks that wages will fall once we reach the end of this transitory inflationary period. I'm saying, who goes to their employees in an expanding economy and says, yeah, we're paying you too much money. Everybody gets a 10% pay cut.
That would almost retire a reset of all wages in the country. You know, unless everybody did it at once, it would just be disaster for whoever does it. So
one of the other areas where prices are holding is in the car business. I mean, people are paying full retail for cars. Used cars are at historically high levels. Car dealers have the same fear that builders have. Are they going to get stuck with inventory that they just bought at the highest price ever? If they can't turn it over quickly, they're going to get stuck with it and it's a loss. But people are saying, I want a car. And they are fiscally in good shape. They're paying the money. How soon are dealers going to say, yeah, let's cut the price. We've been charging too much. That was too much money. We don't need it all. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. House prices, that's a major component, or the rent equivalent's a major component of inflation. When are house prices going to fall? They're going to fall in the next major recession. When is that going to happen? Well, that will bring inflation down, but how transitory is it if it takes another 5, 6, or even 10 years of continuous demand before that recession shows up?
The demand is the key. If the demand stays high, the prices stay high, period. And that's true of any market. And right now, there's a lot of money out there. There's a lot of demand, and the prices are going to stay elevated until we strike an equilibrium, we get some supply back, and then the demand drops. And like you said, Don, the wild card there is no one has a time frame on that.
So the Fed basically has painted itself into a corner, no thanks to Congress, who said after a number of years of trying, decades of trying to create employment and saying, we don't know how to do it, let's make the Fed do it. It's kind of like the old ad, I'm not going to eat that, but Mikey eats anything, you know, let's give it to him. And so the Fed is stuck with the two jobs. One, take control inflation, and two, expand employment. And it's an either-or situation, damned if you do, damned if you don't. You're listening to Investor Resources Show. You want to talk to us during the week. Magic number is 800-317-9119, 800-317-9119. Go to our website. Look at the video tab. Watch some of those. They are very educational. They are not sales pitches. We are out of time here. God bless you, your family, and God bless the USA, and protect our liberties, which are under attack. We'll be back next week.